Accession number 12910, Reel 4.
Mr. Imre, Reel 4.
These two Palestinian constables were put up against a rock and shot in cold blood. I think there was a third, because otherwise we wouldn't have known much about it. But I think he was shot trying to escape, but survived. And I think what must have happened, I think he must have come in, dragged himself in somehow, and reported this. In fact, I'm sure it happened. This is what happened. Anyway, that put the cat among the pigeons completely, and the whole force was alerted. About the same time, Abu Jaldi had turned his attention to Europeans and Jews who used to go down to the Dead Sea from Jerusalem along those tracks, and he would waylay them, and he would rob them, etc. And one lady I know had a very frightening experience when she couldn't get her ring off properly, and one of the highwaymen threatened to cut her finger off. Anyway, he'd become a complete menace, this man, Abu Jaldi and his gang. Deputy Inspector General, was a man called Alan Saunders, and he took over command of operations against Abu Jaldi. This took the form of picketing with police the chain of villages around which Abu Jaldi had been operating. I was, as a member of the striking force, I was on several occasions assigned to one of these village pickets. Up to that time, we used to get news of Abu Jaldi, and we used to rush out there in tenders, and there would be perhaps an exchange of shots, and nothing much would happen. The gang would disappear into the hills, and we'd go back to barracks, feeling rather humiliated. But now, this village picket system came into being, and this was successful. Gradually, we denied these villages to Abu Jaldi and his gang. It was very often a cold, wet picket patrol. It was in winter, and the Palestinian winter can be very cold and very wet. However, it would be a 48-hour tour of duty, and it was obviously having its effect. There was a raid on one of the pickets, and it had been beaten off, and one of the gang had been taken prisoner, and he told us quite a lot about Abu Jaldi. Anyway, gradually, the gang started deserting Abu Jaldi, and finally, right at the end, he was reduced simply to himself and his second-in-command, Zali Amit. Then the end came rather suddenly. Abu Jaldi was a showman. He could quite easily have pushed off into Transjordan, but he was a proud sort of chap. He was a fellaheen, and had he gone into Transjordan, he would have found himself among Bedouin and been really ostracized as a fellaheen. He didn't go into Transjordan when he could have done. He could have got away. Anyway, the end came. It was engineered to a large extent by an Arab assistant superintendent called Abdin Bey, who I can talk about later. He was a man with his nose to the ground. He knew everything. He had heard that Abu Jaldi had taken refuge in a particular cave. he rounded up some of Abu Jilda's relatives, and he handed them over to the officer who was going to command this particular operation towards the cave. I wasn't there in this. I wasn't assigned to this particular job. Anyway, the police party surrounded the cave, shoved the relatives into the cave mouth, and then shouted to Abu Jilda, who was presumed to be inside, "Come out and surrender your arms." Anyway, there was a crackle of musketry, and I believe somebody nearly got shot. They didn't get shot, but they nearly were shot. Anyway, the presence of the relatives in the cave mouth meant that the police were screened from what Abu Jilda might do. Anyway, in due course, he came out and surrendered with Salih Ahmed. He handed over his arms. They were police arms pilfered from the police, and bandoliers absolutely full of ammunition. Anyway, that was the end. He was put up before the courts, of course. He was sentenced to death. I can't remember whether there was an appeal. I saw the execution. He was absolutely unmoved. Tall, gaunt, and a strange thing happened beforehand. He said to the prison superintendent, we were police and prisons, of course, and he said to the police superintendent, may I please have permission to get rid of all this? I want to die with Arab clothes on. May I get rid, please, of all this prison garb that he was arrayed in? And I will have some, if you'll get a message to where I want it to go, I will have some proper Arab clothes brought in. And I would like to die with dressed properly as an Arab. And he was given permission to do it. And he went down, as he came out of the condemned cell, he had to pass Salih Ahmed and somebody else who were waiting to be executed. And he said in Arabic, he said, goodbye all you prisoners. And then he went straight on the trap and down. And he died very well. But that was that.
How does this connect with Mohammed Doshan?
Ah, Mohammed Doshan had been a member of Abu Jilda's gang, and he was never found. I think he probably went over the border into Transjordan. I don't know. I don't know what happened to him. But it was known that he'd been with the Abu Jilda gang.
Now, I think you'd like to bring in some more memories of your service at Ranelagh.
Yes, I would. There are two episodes that occurred there, which might be of interest. Interest, I think, maybe to certainly a policeman. One was, I would call it, I think, an interrupted patrol. Ramley and Lidder, which were in our division, and where I did most of my night duty, were pretty smelly sort of places. They were always dark. There was no street lighting. And one tended to stumble round these alleyways for 8 hours, the 8-hour period of patrol. There was a system whereby one had to make contact with certain points at certain hours of the night. And there was always an inspecting officer, and if you didn't make the required contact, of course, he had a copy of the patrol schedule, and he would know, and he would have you up on the mat if you hadn't done what you should have done. It was 8 hours on one's feet. One had to supply, as far as I remember, I know I always supplied my own torch, but that was the only light one really had. However, there were certain lightnesses over this, because Arab coffee shops in that area always used to stay open until about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. So if you went on patrol to do your 8-hour shift at, let's say, 7 o'clock, you would 7 o'clock in the evening, you would just about be coming off patrol when the coffee shops closed. However, if you went on patrol, started your patrol at, let's say, 10 o'clock in the evening, you would have 2 hours at the end, or 3 hours at the end, whatever it is, when there'd be no coffee shops open. What you did, of course, in order to keep awake and keep going, you came round a corner to a coffee shop, and there were quite a number of them around, and you swallowed a couple of little cup loads of Turkish coffee, and then on you went. By the time you'd finished your patrol, you were absolutely awash with coffee. But that was the way we kept awake. We were allowed 10 minutes interval every 2 hours, but it was fairly tough going around these patrol beats. What I have in mind is the boredom of it all. One used to say, please, please, let something happen to relieve this ghastly boredom, stumbling along by torchlight and drinking a lot of coffee and so on. And one night, I was on patrol with an Arab constable called Jamil, J-A-M-I-L, Jamil. And as we came round a corner, or just as we were about to come round a corner, where there was a coffee shop, suddenly there were piercing screams and yells and groans. And round we came, and there was an Arab on the ground, bleeding profusely. And we just had time to see another Arab disappearing round another corner with some of the coffee shop fraternity rather half-heartedly trying to carry on after him, to catch up with him. Anyway, in the depot, one was always taught your first duty in any emergency is to save life if it's appropriate. So I thought, my goodness me, here's a chap lying there on the ground with the most awful stomach wound. And so down I got on my hands and knees alongside this chap. Meanwhile, Jamil was mingling with the coffee shop fraternity. And he said, he came up to me eventually, and he said, this man is, whatever his name was, I can't remember, and he has been stabbed by his cousin, Hamid. And Hamid and this chap had been sitting there quietly drinking arak. And then there had been a quarrel over some family affair. And so Hamid had immediately stuck his knife into this chap's stomach. And there he was in no state at all. So Jamil produced a filthy piece of padded cloth, which I stuffed into this wound, and then Jamil pulled a kufir off another Arab's head, and I wound it right round the chap's tummy and hoped for the best. And then I sent Jamil off to the telephone, the nearest telephone, which was in the Mukhtar's house, that's the headman's house, and I said, get in touch with the police station and tell them that we urgently need medical assistance. And that I, Imre, have gone after Hassan. Hassan was the, Hamid, I think his name was. Anyway, the chap who knifed the chap on the ground. And so that's what I did. I went stumbling after Hamid, not particularly wanting to catch up with him. Unfortunately, I never did. He was arrested sometime later. And he was put before the courts, and it wasn't a great deal. Under the Ottoman Penal Code, a family vendetta or family quarrel was always regarded with sympathy, and I think he probably got a year, something of that sort, and then out he came. And his cousin, whom he'd stabbed, he recovered, despite my first aid. I was up on the mat because I hadn't made my point at the proper time. Of course, everything was all right as soon as it was all explained. So that was the end of that affair.
So that was typical of the kind of things you might have to deal with regarding cafe brawls?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That was that particular one. But anyway, it relieved the boredom for a little while. I mean, something had happened at last. I think I have one more rambly thing which I've missed out. Oh, yes. And I regard this as a glimpse of history. Has its interest, I think. I used to go up into the coffee houses, the cafes, Arab cafes, and sit among the elders with the object of trying to get my mind round the Arabic, listen to the Arabic, and try to pick up as much as I could. And among this particular coterie in the coffee shop was a man called Abdul, and he was very, very black. And he was one of the older of them. And he said to me one day, he said, you know, he said, I'm not an Arab at all, really. He said, I come from the northern territories of the Gold Coast. He said, my village was near a place called Wah, up on the western side, on the near what is now the French border. And he said, this took some time to tell. In fact, it probably took more than one evening to tell. but he said, I was a boy, he said, possibly 14 or 15, and in my village. And at that time, there was a slave raider called Samory, whose territory was up and down that particular coastline and right down into French territory, further down, further south. And he said, we used to have pickets out because we never knew when these Arab slavers were coming to pick us up. And he said, this was all right, but until one day, he said, I was suddenly taken by surprise, and I was taken prisoner by one of his band, one of Samory's band. And he said, I don't know whether Samory was there at the time. He said, I believe he was, but I wouldn't like to be sure of it. So whether I was looking at this famous brigand, Samory, or not, I don't know. Anyway, he said, what happened was typical of what went on at that time. He said, we were taken in a caravan, a walking caravan, in leg irons and handcuffs and bound right across Africa. He said, about halfway across, we were handed over to the men of another band under the man you call Tipu Tib. Tipu Tib, of course, was the slaver with his headquarters in Zanzibar. And anyway, Tipu Tib, having presumably bought us from Samory's people, then took us to Zanzibar. We were taken by dhow across from the coastline to Zanzibar Island. And there we were put up for sale in the Zanzibar slave mart. There, he said, this chap Abdul said, I was lucky because I fell into the hands of a good master. He said, in due course, I was put with some others into a dhow, and we were taken right up to the Persian Gulf. And there, he said, my master was good to me. He said, in due course, I became a trusted servant in his business. I got all over that part of the Persian Gulf, which, he said, of course, at that time was under Ottoman Turkish rule. He said that went on very well for quite a long time. And then suddenly, he said, I was suddenly surprised again by a Turkish army recruiting party. And he said, I was made to join the Turkish army. And in due course, he said, I fought against the British at the Battle of Gaza. There, he said, I was taken prisoner by the British. And he said, I changed sides and I fought for the British against the Turks. And he said, at the end of the war, I found myself down here in Ramleh. And he said, that is my story.
Did you believe it?
Yes. He used to hold court. He used to hold court many, many people from all over the place. Yes, I did believe it. I had no reason not to at all. I think he actually showed us marks, or I might be getting mixed up with somebody else, marks of the fetters on his. And he was beaten on one occasion. And yes, I think it was Abdul who showed us those marks. Oh, I had no doubt at all.
Did he say anything about the Battle of Gaza?
No. It was getting by that time. I think this was getting towards the end of my time in Ramleh, and I'd like to have gone back and questioned him further. Oh, I tell you one thing he did say about Gaza, the fighting. He said one of the things that helped the Turks tremendously around Gaza was the cactus, the big hedges of cactus. Because, and I've heard that subsequently from somebody else too. So that was that one.
Did the Arabs in Palestine, whilst you were there, ever say anything to you about any contrast or comparison between British rule in Palestine and that which had been carried out by the Turks?
Oh, the general impression was the Turks had been absolutely brutal, as one knows they were. But I would equate that question in, to some extent, a parallel thing that occurred to me many, many years later. From the Gold Coast, I was sent up on a mission into Togoland, which had been under German until the First World War. The end of the First World War, it had been under German domination, German colonial rule. And the people there in Togoland, whom I did talk about, the Germans, German rule and British rule, they said, oh, with the Germans, we knew exactly what we were up against. There was a dividing line. If you went over that dividing line, you knew you were in real trouble. But up to that dividing line, you knew where you were with them. And I think this is, to some extent, a parallel with the Arabs and the Turkish domination of that part of the Middle East.
Were the Togolese implying that with the British, you didn't know?
The British, with the British, they never knew. I mean, anything could happen.
When did you visit Togoland about?
Ooh. The end of 36.
Now, coming back to Palestine, I think that whilst you were there, you met a number of famous personalities. Maybe we could
yes,
talk about them.
Yes, I did. There was my meetings with these people. You must appreciate that I was a young constable with no standing whatever. I'll talk about Haji Amin al-Husseini first. Haji Amin al-Husseini was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. I had been very ill indeed with typhoid. And as I was recovering, I became aware of a tall, craggy man in a long green coat who used to visit the wards. And this was a man called Edward Blatchford. Edward Blatchford was an American, and he'd been in Palestine since before the First World War. And he was in comfortable circumstances. He had a very attractive, very pleasant, comfortable flat opposite the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. And he was a very remarkable man. He a very humane man. And he used to visit these wards. And there was I lying and trying to stay alive. And in due course, I got to know him because he came again and again, visiting everybody, all the British police in the wards. But he and I struck a note together, and in due course, he arranged with my CO for me to go and recuperate in his flat when I was able to stand and get about a bit. So I got to his flat opposite the King David Hotel, and there I met quite a number of people whose names were well known. And among them was Hegemin al-Husseini. I remember meeting him without any doubt at all once, and I think I may have met him a second time. He and Blatchford used to talk in French. The Hegemin, I think, knew English, but I didn't hear him speak it. He was a smallish figure, punctiliously polite, beautifully dressed, and somehow he gave me the impression of a black panther. He was there was something about him, an extraordinary underlying ferocity. He hated the British. Apart from ordinary, common civility, he and I didn't speak at all. All the conversation was between Blatchford and Hegemin. But I got this impression of latent ferocity, latent something or other. There was something about Hegemin which was extremely impressive. He had enormous charisma. But, of course, not speaking to him, I didn't get any further. That concludes any contact I ever had with him.
What year might that have been?
It must have been 34, the first part of 34, I should think.
And I think the Zionist leader, Jabotinsky?
Jabotinsky, strictly speaking, he wasn't a Zionist. He was what was called in those days a revisionist. Jabotinsky was